ॐ अज्ञानातिमिरन्धस्या ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदः मह्यं ददाति स्वापदान्तिकम् वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयुतापदकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगना रघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादान् सहगना ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितंश्च हे कृष्णकरुणा सिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते कोपेश गोपिका कान्ता राधकान्ता नमस्तु ते तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधोभ्येव च पतिदानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे।
This morning we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 54, The Marriage of Krishna and Rukmini. So we'll have the chapter summary and the first five shlokas.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
This chapter describes how Lord Shri Krishna defeated the opposing kings after kidnapping Rukmini, disfigured Rukmini's brother Rukmi, brought Rukmini to his capital and married her. As Shri Krishna was taking Princess Rukmini away, the inimical kings gathered their armies and pursued him. Lord Baladev and the generals of the Yadava army turned to face these opponents, blocking their advance. The enemy armies then began pouring incessant showers of arrows upon Lord Krishna's army. Seeing her husband-to-be's forces under such violent attack, Srimati Rukmini looked at Shri Krishna fearfully. But Krishna simply smiled and told her that there was nothing to fear, because his army would surely destroy the enemy in short order. Lord Balaram, the other heroes, then began to annihilate the opposing army with Naracha arrows. The enemy kings, headed by Jarasandha, retreated after suffering the destruction of their armies at the hands of the Yadavas. Jarasandha consoled Shishupal. Happiness and distress are never permanent and are under the control of the Supreme Lord. 17 times Krishna defeated me, but in the end I was victorious over him. Thus, seeing that victory and defeat are under the control of destiny and time, I have learned not to succumb to either lamentation or joy. Time now favors the Yadavas, so they have defeated you with only a small army. But in the future, time will favor you, and you will surely conquer them. Consoled in this way, Shishupal took his followers and returned to his kingdom. Rukmini's brother Rukmi, who hated Krishna, was infuriated by Krishna's kidnapping of his sister. So, after vowing before all the kings present that he would not return to Kundina until Krishna had been destroyed and Rukmini rescued, Rukmi set out with his army to attack the Lord. Ignorant of Lord Krishna's glories, Rukmi boldly went out to attack Krishna in a lone chariot. He approached the Lord, struck him with arrows, and demanded that he release Rukmini. Shri Krishna fended off Rukmini's weapons, breaking them to pieces. Then he raised his sword high and was about to kill Rukmini, when Rukmini interceded and fervently pleaded that her brother's life be spared. Lord Krishna did not kill Rukmini, but with his sword he shaved off bits of Rukmini's hair here and there, leaving him disfigured. Just then Lord Baladev appeared on the scene with the Yadava army. Seeing Rukmini disfigured, he gently reproached Krishna. To disfigure such a close family member is as good as killing him. Therefore he should not be killed but set free. Lord Baladev then told Rukmini that the sorry condition of her brother was only the fruit of his past work, since everyone is responsible for his own happiness and suffering. He further instructed her about the transcendental position of the jiva soul, and how the illusion of happiness and distress is simply the result of ignorance. Accepting Lord Balaram's instructions, Rukmini gave up her sorrow. Rukmi, meanwhile, felt totally frustrated, deprived as he was of all his strength and his will to fight. Since he had vowed not to return home without conquering Krishna, Rukmini constructed a city on that very spot and took up residence there in a mood of undiminished anger. Lord Krishna took Rukmini to his capital, Dwarka, and married her. All the citizens celebrated in lavish style, broadcasting throughout the city accounts of how the Lord had kidnapped Rukmini. Everyone in Dwarka was delighted to see Lord Krishna united with Rukmini. So we'll chant the first four together, and then we'll do number five responsibly. Text one.
Shri Shuka Uvacha Iti Sarve Susamrabdha Vahanaruhyadamshitah Svair Svair Balai Parikranta Anviyurdhita Karmukha.
Shukadeva Goswami said, having thus spoken, all those infuriated kings donned their armor and mounted their conveyances. Each king, bow in hand, was surrounded by his own army as he went after Lord Krishna. Text 2.
Tanapatata alokya yadavanika yutapa tastus tatsam mukharajan vispurja svadhunum shite.
The commanders of the Yadava army, seeing the enemy racing to attack, turned to face them and stood firm, O king, twanging their bows. Text 3.
Ashvaprishte gajaskande ratopaste strakovidah mumuchus sharavarshani mega adrishvapoyatha.
Mounted on the backs of horses, the shoulders of elephants, and the seats of chariots, the enemy kings, expert with weapons, rain down arrows upon the Yadus like clouds pouring rain on mountains. Next 4.
Patyurbalam sharasaraish channam vikshyasu madhyama savridam aikshat tadvaktram vaya vihlalochana.
Slender waisted Rukmini, seeing her lord's army covered by torrents of arrows, shyly looked at his face with fear stricken eyes. We'll do 5 together.
Rahasya. Bhagavan Aha Rahasya Bhagavan Aha Rahasya Bhagavan Aha Ma Sma Bhair Vamalochane Ma Sma Bhair Vamalochane Masma Bhairava Malochane Vinang Shantyat Yadhunai Vaitat Vinangshat Yadhunai Vaitat Vinangshat Yadhunai Vaitat Tavakai Shatravam Balam Tavakai Shatravam Balam Tavakai Shatravam Balam Rahasya Bhagavanaha Masma Bhairava Malochane Vinangshat Yadhunai Vaitat Tavakai Shatravam Balam Rahasya Bhagavanaha Masma Bhairava Malochane Vinangshat Yadhunai Vaitat Tavakai Shatravam Balam. Rahasya Bhagavanaha Masma Bhairava Malochane Vinangshat Yadhunai Vaitat Avakai Shatravam Balam. Rahasya Aha Asma Bhair Vamalochane Vinanshat Yadhunai Vaitat Tavakai Shatravam Balam.
That's just
Tahasya Bhagavan Aham. Avakai Shatravam Balam. Rahasya,
laughing. Bhagavan, the Supreme Lord.
Aha, said. Masma bhai,
do not be afraid.
Vamalochane,
O beautiful eyed one.
Vinamshati,
will be destroyed.
Adhuna eva,
just now.
Etat,
this.
Tavakai,
by your army.
Shatravam,
of enemies.
Balam,
force. Translation. In response, the Lord laughed and assured her, "Do not be afraid, beautiful eyed one. This enemy force is about to be destroyed by your soldiers." Report. To express his great affection for Rukmini, Lord Krishna gallantly referred to his own Yadava army as your men, indicating that the Lord's entire dynasty was now the property of his beloved queen. The Supreme Lord Krishna desires to share his blissful opulences with all living beings, and thus he sincerely invites them to come back home, back to Godhead. The Krishna consciousness movement, introduced throughout the world by Srila Prabhupada and the order of his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who himself preached all over India on the order of his exalted father, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, is broadcasting the loving message of Lord Krishna. Remember him, serve him, return to him, and share in the infinite bounty of the kingdom of God. So yesterday's verses was the climax of the pastime where Krishna appeared in response to Rukmini's prayers and gathered her up into his chariot and rode off. Not quite into the sunset, but that'll be next. And here the enemy soldiers are pursuing, you know, trying to obstruct the Lord and deny him taking away Rukmini. I think all of us have been really relishing this pastime. There are so many different facets and rasas here. And just personally, I, as it may not sound very shastric or maybe not our Siddhanta, but personally I really relish these pastimes, Dwarka pastimes, more than Vrindavan even. There are so many different aspects and so many different personalities and situations which are going to be unfolding before us in the next chapters, and very, very relishable to hear of Krishna's activities in these scenarios. In fact, in this pastime, it seems to me that all the different rasas are contained. There are seven secondary rasas, and all of them, in some part or other, are apparent here in this pastime. So humor is uparasa. First uparasa is humor. And right in this verse, Krishna is laughing and reassuring Rukmini not to be worried about the battle. And another one of the uparasas is compassion. So the Lord, he took compassion on Rukmini in the first place to kidnap her. Astonishment is another one of the rasas. So it's very astonishing how the kings were all very astonished to see how Krishna had taken away Rukmini in front of all of them. Chivalry, of course, would be the major rasa here. Very chivalrously, Krishna has come to Vidarbha and eloped with, abducted Rukmini, taken her away, showing his great chivalrous spirit. Anger is another one of the rasas. These kings are all very outraged and angry at how Krishna has done this, had the audacity to do this, and they even knew it was coming, but they still weren't able to stop him. The last two are dread and ghastliness. So, as we'll see soon in this carnage which is about to take place, the opposing kings were unable to stop Krishna, stop Balaram. And so there was a very ghastly battle scene, and you know, so many different emotions are present here. So in just in this one pastime, you can see so much variety, so many rasas. Krishna is reciprocating with his devotees, and the opponents of the Lord are also going through various emotions. So it's very, very relishable pastime for us to fix our minds on. In one sense, the endeavor of the kings to stop Krishna, it's not just futile because they can never defeat him, but it's also futile because now that Krishna has taken Rukmini, it's already too late for any, you know, it's too late for anything else to happen. Even if, in theory, they were able to defeat Krishna and rescue Rukmini, she wouldn't be able to marry anyone else. That was the custom in those days, that once the girl has been touched by another man or taken by another man, then she won't be able to marry anyone else. She has to marry that person only. And we see this in other stories in the Shastra. Just like when Samba, Krishna's son, he similarly abducted Lakshmana, who was Duryodhana's daughter. And in that case, the Kauravas chased Samba and actually defeated him and captured him and imprisoned him. But when Balaram came to mediate, he said, we don't want to fight the whole between the two dynasties. You should just give back Samba and Lakshmana, because it's too late anyhow. He's already, he referred to Lakshmana as Samba's wife, because once Samba had taken Lakshmana onto his chariot, then they're considered a couple, they're married, and it can't be reversed. So similarly here, although the kings are outraged and they want to show some defiance, actually there was no real hope for them to reverse the situation. Once Krishna had taken Rukmini on his chariot, he was now his wife. Even apart from the higher understanding that Krishna and Rukmini are eternal husband and wife, she's goddess of fortune and Narayan and all that, even on a very external level, there was no use in trying to take her back. So this is the kind of marriage known as the Rakshasa Vivaha. So there are eight kinds of marriage as described in the Manu Samhita, and I was just going to briefly go over the eight kinds of marriage. Srila Prabhupada occasionally mentions them. So the ideal marriage is called the Brahma marriage, where the father and the parents, they choose a qualified young man to bestow their daughter upon. And we see examples of this in the Shastra, especially comes to mind the chapter where Swayambhuva Manu is approaching Kardama Muni to bestow Devahuti upon him. So this is considered the most proper, best form of marriage. The second one is the Daiva marriage. And if one isn't able to search out at the right time a suitable groom for the girl, then the father would take the girl to where a sacrifice is being performed and bestow his daughter upon the priest. Because automatically, if someone is officiating in a sacrifice, then he's very qualified, he's well-situated, has already a livelihood. So in that case, the daughter can be handed over to such a qualified person. Then there's the Arsha rite, which each of these are kind of less ideal than the other. Then in this case, that even the second option wasn't possible for the father. So then he will even agree to marry his daughter to someone who's older, an older man, and he'll accept some gifts, such as cow or bulls, in exchange for his daughter. Then the fourth one is Prajapatya. And if those three were not possible, then by now the girl is already getting older, and there is a concern that she may pass the child-bearing age. So then they're less picky, and basically the father will just find someone who's hopefully qualified and honor him and hand over his daughter. So these are in decreasing order of ideal situation. Then there's the Asura rite, which is basically the party of the groom offers many gifts to the father because they want to marry the girl. And she may be exceptionally qualified or beautiful. And basically, it's almost like a financial transaction. She is almost given to the groom's family because of the great financial benefit to the father. So this is also not very ideal. Then there's the Gandharva rite, which we hear about sometimes, where the girl and the boy meet on their own. There may be different circumstances for that. And they decide they will marry each other, and they marry each other by exchange of garlands. This is common in the Gandharva society, based on attraction. Then there's the Rakshasa rite, which we are covering here, where the Lord, this is especially for Kshatriyas, where they forcibly abduct the girl and fight off all the opponents and carry her off in triumph. And this is especially prevalent among the Kshatriyas, as I said. Krishna, not only in this case, in other cases also, he had to fight to marry some of his other queens. And it's also it's very honorable actually for a Kshatriya to marry a girl in this way. Of course, in this case also, the girl should be agreeable, or at least not against being taken away by a certain prince or king. There's another instance where Bhishma abducted three girls, three sisters, Amba, Ambika, Ambalika. Of course, Bhishma was a brahmachari, but for his brothers, he was taking these girls to marry Vichitravirya. And one of the girls had already decided to marry Shalva, and when Bhishma took her back to his kingdom, she told him that, "I can't marry your brother, because I was already planning to marry Shalva, and he was also planning to, I was just about to garland him. So, you know, I can't marry anyone else. My mind was already set." So, in that case, the Rakshasa marriage wasn't completed, and she actually went back, and there were many different things happened after that. But even in the Rakshasa marriage, the girl is agreeable to be won in this way, because whoever was able to do that, obviously, is the most powerful and qualified prince. Therefore, she'll be happy to marry him, as opposed to any of the others. And the final one is the Pishacha rite. Pishacha means like dark, like we have in the song Pishachira Kole, the lap of the witch Maya. So the Pishacha is demoniac rite of marriage, where the girl is abducted against her will. And in this case, the first one that comes to mind would be Sita being abducted by Ravana. Not only is it against her will, but she's already married. So there's really no question of her agreeing to Ravana. So that is the worst of the marriages. That's the Pishacha marriage. So in Prabhupada, in one place he mentions that in Kali Yuga, in previous yugas, these other marriages in other societies, in the higher planets, these other marriages were customary, but in Kali Yuga, the only ideal marriage, recommended marriage, is the Brahma marriage, where the parents take responsibility to offer their daughter to a very qualified groom. So this is just a little summary of these different kinds of marriage. So here in the Rakshasa system, as I stressed, once the girl has been taken by the prince, there's no question of her marrying anybody else. So Krishna has already served his purpose by taking Rukmini away. And it's very nice here in the verse how Krishna addresses her as beautiful-eyed. In the previous verse, it says that Rukmini's eyes were full of fear. Bhaya vihvala lochana. But here, Krishna doesn't see her eyes full of fear. He sees her eyes as being very beautiful. Vama lochane, O beautiful-eyed one. So he's reassuring her also. Now we are married, as if we're already married, So these soldiers are all your soldiers, and they will very quickly defeat the enemy. So, of course, in Kali Yuga, there are all different various kinds of marriage ceremonies that take place. And as Prabhupada often quoted from the 12th canto, basically the marriage will take place between the boy and the girl based on attraction and mutual consent. There is no deep analysis of the personalities, of the astrological compatibility of the families. Marriage is really something that is a responsibility of the parents for their children. But in Kali Yuga, especially as it progresses more and more, we see it already, many parents don't even want to be involved in the marriage of their children. They want to take responsibility. If something goes wrong, then they don't want to take the blame. So they leave it for the children to find their own partners. And without proper training, then the young people, they don't really know what to look for. It's often based on fantasy, romance, these things which are not very substantial when you're looking for a long-term husband and wife relationship. And so you have different kinds of ways that people get together online and through social events. And then there are also different kinds of weddings which are beyond the scope of the Vedic eight weddings. You have these destination weddings, and you have event-themed weddings and different such things. And also, especially in Las Vegas, it's famous for having drive-through weddings, where the couple sit in their car and there's a booth where they drive up to, sign the papers, pay a little fee, and they drive off, perhaps into the sunset with their marriage certificate. And so, I'm not sure who was the inventor of this very interesting concept, but we can see that Krishna is the original everything. So here, the original drive-through wedding is taking place right here, where Krishna is driven up in his chariot, he's taken the bride, and he's driving off into the sunset. I was just reading an article, which is quite interesting, about this concept of marriage and divorce, and again related to this Las Vegas, Nevada laws, where in Nevada you can get not only can you get married very easily, but you can also divorce very easily. One simply has to show that one's lived in the state for 6 weeks, and that's it. Basically, you can go to the office and sign. Both parties don't even need to be there. Either party who wishes to divorce, one of them can go stay in Nevada for 6 weeks, and someone has to vouch that they've been there for 6 weeks, and then they can legally get a divorce decree. And it's very unfortunate because the article I read was talking about how in South Korea, now many people are going to Nevada just to get divorced, because in traditional Asian cultures, they put a lot more value and importance on maintaining the relationships. So if you want to divorce in South Korea, you have to undergo court-appointed counseling. You have to wait 3 months, just like a cooling-off period, to think about it. And that's even if both parties are want to get divorced. If there's a dispute, then it's even more drawn-out process. So people, to avoid this, they're just going to Nevada and staying there for 6 weeks so they can get divorced very easily. And the civil authorities in South Korea are kind of upset at this. We're trying to encourage the couples to stay together, but they're just finding this loophole and going overseas to get divorced very easily. So it's a very unfortunate, one of Kali Yuga's advancements, that people can get married at the drop of a hat and also divorce very, very easily. This is something which is very much condemned in the Shastra, and also Srila Prabhupada is also very disappointed when devotees who were married under his guidance or in his presence weren't able to maintain those marriage vows. So that's another whole subject which perhaps we can leave for another day. The second point I wanted to stress on was how Krishna is reassuring Rukmini that they'll surely be victorious. Because if Krishna is on your side, then really you don't have anything to worry about. No matter who your opponent is and how heavily the odds seem to be stacked against you, just that one one aspect of Krishna is with you, then you have nothing to fear. And Srila Prabhupada, in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he quotes one verse, Jayastu Pandu Bhutranam Yesham Pakshya Janardana. A very simple shloka, saying, glories to the Pandavas, the sons of Pandu, on whose side Krishna was. On whose side Krishna was. Yesham Pakshya Janardana. So all glory is automatically, all victory will automatically be with the Pandavas just because Krishna is on their side. Externally, if you look at it, the Pandava army was 7 Akshahinis, the Kauravas had 11. So that's a huge disparity, you know, 7 versus 11. And the heroes on the Kaurava side were, you know, if you listen, as Duryodhana is listing them in the beginning of the first chapter, and actually, if you line up the two armies and the heroes on both sides, the Kaurava army was definitely more powerful. They had more, you know, big-name fighters, and they had more number of soldiers. So Duryodhana had every reason to be confident that he would defeat the Pandavas. But just because of this one aspect, Yesham Pakshya Janardana, because Krishna was with the Pandavas, therefore, despite all odds, they were able to defeat and conquer the Kauravas completely. So Prabhupada Samas quote this verse to encourage the devotees also, that if you're strict in your principles, if you're worshipping the Lord nicely, then he'll definitely favor you, and you'll also be able to conquer all obstacles, even in the execution of Krishna consciousness. And of course, we know also the last verse of the Bhagavad Gita, Yatra Yogeshvara Krishna Yatra Partha Dhanurdhara Tatra Shri Vijayo Bhuti Dhruva Nitir Madir Mama. Throughout the Gita, Sanjay is trying to hint to Dhritarashtra that your sons are not going to be victorious. And especially in the first chapter, there are many hints at this. When the Pandavas and Krishna blow their conch shells, it shatters the hearts of the Kauravas. And just the fact that they're fighting at Kurukshetra, which is a holy place, that will help the pious side. And at the end, the last verse, he very bluntly tells Dhritarashtra that wherever there's Krishna, wherever there's Arjuna, there will be victory, beauty, power, morality. These things will go hand in hand. So because Krishna is on the side of the Pandavas, there is no question of their defeat. Rather, the Kauravas will be defeated. And it's interesting because Krishna was siding with the Pandavas very obviously. Balaram, however, he was quite favorable to the Kauravas. He actually liked Duryodhana a lot. And even though Balaram wasn't necessarily favorable as much, because Krishna was on the side of the Pandavas, therefore they were victorious. It's interesting to note that before the battle started, when the armies were gathering and all the allies were either going to the Kauravas or the Pandavas side, so Balaram came to meet with the Pandavas. This was the first big meeting actually before, after the Pandavas had come out of hiding. And there was a conference of the Pandavas allies. And Krishna, he spoke up very strongly that, you know, now the exile has been completed, the Kauravas are duty-bound to return the kingdom to the Pandavas, half the kingdom. And we should, you know, we should demand this, but we should also expect to fight, because probably they won't give it. And during this, after Krishna's finished speaking, then Balaram spoke. And he actually was, the Pandavas were surprised, because he started saying things that, it's not really, you can't really blame the Kauravas, Yudhishthira is the one who lost the gambling match. He gambled away everything. The Kauravas are the rulers. You know, you should offer them due respect. You know, don't be disrespectful to them. You should speak humbly with them. And Pandavas were quite surprised. Said, "How is Balaram speaking like this?" You know, everyone knows the story how we were cheated. And after Balaram finished speaking, then Satyaki, who was one of the Yadava heroes from Dwarka, he couldn't tolerate actually Balaram's speech, and he got up and started, you know, very angrily kind of denouncing Balaram's speech and saying, "This is totally wrong. The Pandavas were cheated. We have to, you know, I will personally go and kill all of them and give the kingdom back to the Kauravas if, you know, if Balaram feels like this." So even if Balaram wasn't in agreement, just because Krishna was on the side of the Pandavas, they were victorious. And Balaram also recused himself from the battle. Pretty much all the kings of the world, they were on one side or the other. And Balaram came to the Pandavas and said, You know, I told Krishna to be neutral in this battle, but he's favoring you, and there's no way that I can be involved in this because, you know, I can't fight against my brother. I can't, you know, fight against the Kauravas either. I'm just going to recuse myself, and I'm going to go on pilgrimage instead of taking any side in this battle. You know, because Krishna's with you, definitely you'll be victorious. And Balaram, he exited, and we know that he, you know, traveled to the holy places, and that's described in Krishna book during that period. And interestingly, kind of coming full circle, the other king who came at that time was Rukmi, same Rukmi who is going to be humiliated by Krishna in a few verses. So after, as we read in the summary, after Rukmi was defeated by Krishna, he vowed he wouldn't return to his capital, so he had to make a separate city for himself. And even though he harbored this anger against Krishna for many years, later on in the 10th canto we'll see how he actually offered his daughter to marry Pradyumna, Krishna's son, and even his granddaughter he married to Aniruddha. So he was very attached to Rukmini. So to please her, he was still on good terms with her. So he thought, although he wasn't invited particularly by the Pandavas, he showed up at their camp with his army and strode into the camp of the Yudhishthira's tent where they were having a conference. And very proudly he said, "Don't worry, all of you. Now that I'm here, the Kauravas have no chance. I'll fight for you, and my might is such that I'll defeat, even by myself, I can defeat all the Kauravas and hand you the kingdom." So he wasn't invited, and he was speaking very bragging, boastful words. And Arjuna just looked at him and laughed, said, "You know, who are you? Who do you think you are? We don't need your help. Who was there to help me when I defeated the demons in the heavenly planets? Who was there to help me in the forest when I defeated the Gandharvas, or when I defeated the whole Kaurava army at Virat? You know, we don't need your help. If you want to stay, you can stay, but, you know, don't be so proud." So Rukmi, being a Kshatriya, a very proud Kshatriya, he was hurt by those words, you know, because he had approached in such a proud manner. He was put in his place. So he decided, well, if they don't want me, I'll go fight for Duryodhan then. And but anyway, that's good because Krishna's on their side, on the Pandava side, and if I fight against Krishna, I'll maybe be able to get back at him. So he went to Duryodhan's camp and he did the same thing. He barged in and announced himself very grandly and said, "Don't worry, now that I'm here, the Pandavas have no chance." And similarly, Duryodhan also didn't tolerate his proud speech and said, "You know, I'm not sure who you are or who you think you are, but we don't need you. We have Bhishma, Karna, Drona, we're set." So both armies rejected Rukmi. He's quite a tragic figure. As he wanted to fight for the Pandavas, they rejected him. He wanted to fight for the Kauravas, they also rejected him. So he simply had to return to his kingdom, being rejected by both parties. So he's quite a tragic figure in this. Even in this chapter, he's going to boast in front of all the kings that he's going to defeat Krishna. He, against everyone's wishes, he was trying to marry Rukmini to Shishupal, his friend. But in every endeavor, he was baffled and defeated. So this is a demoniac mentality. He's always trying to make some trouble, and he was never successful. And ultimately, later on, he was killed by Balaram, as we'll see in a future chapter. The final point I wanted to make was, again, on the same point of Krishna is on your side, then nobody can defeat you. Prabhupada would also quote a Bengali saying, "Rake Krishna Marake, Mare Krishna Rakeke." It's a very simple verse which says that if Krishna wants to protect you, no one can kill you, and if Krishna wants to kill you, no one can protect you. And if we look a little deeper into this, in Srila Prabhupada's own life, not in a martial sense, but just in the sense of carrying out his mission. In this purport, it's talked about that Krishna consciousness movement was introduced throughout the world by Srila Prabhupada and the order of his Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So similarly, the odds were really stacked against Prabhupada succeeding in planting Krishna consciousness in the West, just as the odds were stacked against the Pandavas. But, you know, if we just look at it, it's almost inconceivable that Srila Prabhupada was able to come to the, you know, first that he came, first that he was even able to leave India. If you read in his diary, the difficulties he had to undergo just to get a passport, just to get a visa, just to get clearance from the Indian government to leave India, to get a free ticket on the steamship company. So many hassles he had to undergo just to leave India, what to speak of, you know, be successful in America. And he had no money, he had no real contacts, just Gopal Agarwal in Butler, Pennsylvania, which is a very small town. And, you know, even the early devotees couldn't even understand Prabhupada's accent very well. If you hear the early recordings of Srila Prabhupada, his voice is not as, I don't know what the word is, confident, clear, perhaps, as in the 70s. If you hear the lectures from 67, it's not as clear. And of course, Prabhupada was brought up speaking British English, and, you know, Americans have a really slightly different English, what to speak of his accent. And many devotees, they couldn't even really understand everything he was saying. So there's so many reasons, you know, very valid reasons, that we would expect Prabhupada not to be able to succeed. And even sometimes he was going to the Jaladuta, the India steamship company office in New York, to see when is the next boat. You know, if it doesn't work out, when can I catch the boat back to India? So many difficulties he had to undergo. But because, again, the same point, because Krishna was on his side, Yesham Paksha Janardana, therefore he was successful, he was victorious. And he even said that you know, Krishna, when he was writing his outpouring, his bhajan that he wrote on the ship, as he docked into Boston Harbor, he wrote one song, and previously he'd written one song on the way. And he's completely surrendering himself to the Lord. He says, I don't know why you brought me here. And he just got off and walked around Boston Harbor. And, you know, that was his first taste of America. And next year is the 50th anniversary. There's going to be a lot of big festivals commemorating Srila Prabhupada's departure from India and his arrival in America. He just walked around the harbor and he got an idea of, you know, what he's up against. And so he went back to the ship and wrote the song. Rajas tamo gune ere sabai achanno. These people are totally covered over by Rajagun and Tamagun. And how will they hear the pure sattvic, shuddha sattvic message of the Lord? So Prabhupada just surrendered himself. And the famous line, he said, you make me a puppet. Just as you make a puppet dance on the string, my Lord, you have to make me dance like that. And then maybe they'll be able to understand my message. So that act of full surrender and following the instructions of his spiritual master empowered Srila Prabhupada to be successful in his preaching mission. Otherwise, externally, there seemed to be really no way that he could succeed. Nothing was really in his favor. Even the famous 40 rupees that he took with him, he wasn't even able to exchange it. You know, 40 rupees... Even now, if you take 40 rupees to JFK, I don't think you'll be able to exchange it. I want to speak of in the 60s at the harbor. The same 40 rupees that he had, he couldn't exchange it, and he actually kept it with him all those years. And when he went back to India the first time with Kirtananda, when he was after his stroke, he flew back to India to recover his health, he used those 40 rupees to pay for the taxi from the airport to his room in Delhi. Even though we say he had 40 rupees, but actually he had nothing because it wasn't exchangeable in those days. So despite everything, Srila Prabhupada was successful because Krishna was on his side. And he also encouraged the devotees that if you maintain your sadhana and your surrender to the Lord, then Krishna will definitely remove all the obstacles in your preaching mission also. So just a few thoughts on the lessons we learned from these verses. And unless there are some comments or questions, we can end here. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. Earlier, you quote the Maharajas from the Manu Smriti.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I understand, the laws of mankind is coming through the Manu Smriti. But I guess because over the ages, I guess some have been changed. But especially in Kali Yuga, it's quite difficult to really follow some of these.
Mm-hmm.
But still the origin is there, really. But I know, like, a lot of devotees and even people outside, they don't like to hear of the management. You know, they think it's outdated, it's mm-hmm. too harsh and so on. Yeah. What's your, say, your realization on this?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things are not really applicable in Kali Yuga. Prabhupada also didn't stress, you know, put that much emphasis on shastras like the Manusmriti, Manusmriti. But at the same time, he wanted Varnashram to be established, so there are certain basic rules and guidelines that, you know, one needs to follow. And, you know, basically one should be in an ashram, not a brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas, and one should be acting in a varna, either brahminically or managerially or in business or in service. So there are some basic principles we can rely upon, but the nitty-gritties and the very detailed, even Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is given by our acharyas, there are so many details of personal items of purity and very technical deity worship, which are not, you know, necessarily relevant to us, and Prabhupada didn't emphasize so much the importance of those things. Especially when we're preaching mission, we have to, you know, Prabhupada gave us a basic program, basic outline, and that's sufficient, you know, for us. Maybe some nice principles we can, you know, incorporate, but it's not, you know, our main books are not Manusmriti, Hari Bhakti Vilas, but Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that's how Prabhupada introduced. He even said, if I tell you all the rules, you'll faint. So we respect those shastras, and maybe certain principles we can follow, but, you know, what Srila Prabhupada gave to us was especially tailor-made for the current day and age. And these things are more... And he gave us, like, the highest principles of Krishna consciousness, which are beyond the principles of morality or religion, you know, which are more basic, you know, just things for general society. And so I think it's quite a big subject, but like the list of marriages, you know, it's mentioned a few times in Prabhupada's purports also, so I thought we can just briefly go over them and especially stress that the ultimate best kind of marriage is when the parents take full responsibility to find a suitable husband for their daughter. And if there are suitable boys, then that won't be a problem. It'll be a very nice arrangement. Yeah, so we don't need to get too much into, you know, details from these more obscure texts. We emphasize what Srila Prabhupada gave us in Bhagavatam Lord Kutra. Back there, Mike?
It's true that Srila Prabhupada threw all kinds of difficulties whenever he came to America. And he did an amazing thing by coming with only 40 rupees and on the boat. But at no time, in my experience, did he not know what he was going to do. He actually said things like, I have many temples, but I'm simply separated by time. He also predicted his world Sankirtan party, or he talked about how he's going to have it, and he talked about the auditorium he had, and there were so many things that indicated in the very early days, Srila Prabhupada was not at all... Although he lamented that, oh my God, look at the civilization, they're just covered with, how am I going to reach them? At the same time, he knew what he was sent to do, and he was aware that that he was the commander-in-chief of Lord Chaitanya's army. He just looked at the situation and said, these people are practically hopeless. How am I going to ever hear them? I mean, how are they ever going to hear me? And so please let them hear what I have to say. But to think of him as just like if we were into a situation like that, supposing I went to Alaska or I went to some place that there were no devotees, and I would have like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? I really don't think it was at all like that. I think he really had a very, very clear understanding of what he was here to do and what the future was. That was my experience. And so far as his British English, yes, it was a little hard to understand on first time you met him, but amazingly, his English was it was very perfect, actually. I think in the very beginning, maybe the very first time, but British English is actually more clear and more clipped than our English is. So I feel that to say that he really didn't, it's too much putting him on the same level as us to say that he went through certain things with certain attitudes. He really wasn't from this world. He really understood completely what he was doing, in the sense that Krishna even told him, go to the world and write some books. And he didn't want to leave. I don't want to leave. Why would anybody want to leave the spiritual world? He says, oh, just go for a little while. Just go write some books and then come back. And so I don't really feel that to superimpose our struggles or what we would go through in struggling to set up a temple or set up something, anything, it's just not the same. In my experience, Srila Prabhupada was completely transcendental at all times, and he could see through everything. I mean, if a check was lost in the mail, nobody even knew the check was lost yet, but he knew the check was lost before anybody knew the check was lost. I mean, he had all the mystic siddhis. He didn't display them all the time, because a devotee doesn't do that. A pure devotee doesn't display all of his mystic siddhis. But Srila Prabhupada had them all. He could do anything and everything that are, you know, that the mystic siddhis. So I don't feel comfortable with this concept of Srila Prabhupada being too much using our own experience as a reference. I guess that's the best way to put it. I don't know how else to say it. I feel like we have to maintain or adopt the mood that he really knew what he was doing at every moment, and he really could foresee the future, and he was completely in touch with Krishna at every moment of every second, and that whatever he did it with full consciousness. The Lord was sitting right there with him, and that's what acharya means. And so anyway, that was just how I felt about that.
Just going to say, well, he did mention that Krishna was on his side, and that, I mean, don't minimize the fact that he did say that Krishna was on his side, therefore he did mention several times that Krishna was on his side. Esham Pache Janardana uses just as the Pandavas, so that part was there also. You know, but one time, I remember going to Sweden in 78 after Prabhupada left. And the local devotees, they weren't listening to Prabhupada tapes, but the local guru. And I asked them, they all speak English pretty good in Sweden. And they said, oh, we don't understand, you know, Prabhupada. So that question is sometimes there. Like, they weren't face-to-face maybe with him, so they hearing tapes. And Prabhupada already left the year before, so. And then, of course, that mood was there, the new guru mood, but... He did say like that. I was like astounded. I said, you don't listen to Prabhupada. It's only been 6 months since Prabhupada left, and they don't listen to Prabhupada tapes now? What? Yeah. But anyway, that's another story.
Okay, thank you. అంటే శ్రీమద్ భాగవతానికి గోపాదికి